Welcome, and thank you for standing by. I'd like to inform all participants that your lines have been placed on listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. To ask a question at that time, please press star one. Today's call is also being recorded. If anyone disagrees, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. John Leslie, Public Affairs Officer with NOAA Office of Communications. Thank you, and you may begin.
Thank you very much, and thank you to everyone who has dialed in to hear this discussion of the NOAA and NASA data for the 2018 global temperature record and other climate highlights from the year. NOAA will also report on 2018 climate highlights of the United States, including an update to the billion-dollar disasters. NOAA and NASA are two keepers of the world's temperature data and independently produce a record of Earth's surface temperatures as well as changes based on historical observations over land and ocean. Consistency between these two independent analyses and those produced by science agencies in other countries, such as the UK Met Service, increase our confidence in the accuracy and assessment of the data and resulting conclusions. These analyses help provide government and business leaders with critical decision-making information. Today's update will feature two short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the speaker's presentations can be found at ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC for State of the Climate /briefings. And NASA is live streaming today's call at nasa.gov/live. Our first presenter is Gavin Schmidt, Director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City, who will summarize the average global temperature data for 2018 and other climate indicators. And our final presenter is Deke Arndt, Chief of the Monitoring Section of NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville, North Carolina, who will provide a summary of U.S. temperature and climate data and an update to the list of billion-dollar disasters. We will now begin with Gavin Schmidt from NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Gavin?
Thank you, John. Good morning. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening to this briefing. I'm going to go straight to slide number two, which is a map of where the anomalies are in temperature in 2018, baselines to the period that that we generally use as our control, which is 1950 to 1981. And you can see that across the globe, 2018 was extremely warm, with only a few places that were slightly below our normal period, notably in the North Atlantic and a few spots around the southern oceans. 2018 had a 0.83 degrees Celsius anomaly compared to our baseline. That's 1.49, 1.5 Fahrenheit above that average, and was quite clearly the fourth warmest year in our record, which goes back to 1880 and probably was warmer than many, many hundreds of years before that. The other warm years, of course, were 2016, which was the warmest year, followed by 2017 and then 2015. 2015 and 17 are quite close together, and in different analyses, those rankings are swapped. But in fact, all of the records suggest that 2018 was in fact the fourth warmest year. Over to you, Deke.
Thank you, Gavin. This is Deke Arndt. Slide three is a very similar picture of the global temperature, what we call anomalies or departures from average for 2018. We compare our temperatures to the 20th century average, which is slightly different than the 1951 to 1980 average that NASA GIST uses. So our anomaly of 0.79 degrees Celsius and 1.42 degrees Fahrenheit is against the 20th century average. Comparing the anomalies between NASA and NOAA in this way is a little bit comparing apples and oranges, but Gavin is going to put them side by side on a common base period here in a few minutes and kind of walk us through how the data sets are behaving with respect to each other. You can see some notes on the side margins of this slide. I think some important points to point out are Europe and the Middle East and parts of Siberia and Far East Russia were quite warm, including into Alaska, were quite warm versus recent conditions. Again, the patterns that you see in this map are similar to the patterns that you saw that Gavin presented. The interior part of northern North America was on the cool side of recent history, particularly the prairie provinces of Canada. If we were to break down the global temperature into land-only and ocean-only components, they would be 2.02 degrees Fahrenheit for the land and 1.19 Fahrenheit for the ocean, warmer than that 20th century average. Both of these are also fourth warmest year on record. And as Gavin said, we were fairly clearly in the fourth warmest slot with room on either side of that. I'm going to move on to slide number four, which shows 2018's global temperature in a longer-term context. So looking at this graphic from left to right, our individual years from 1880 on the left through 2018 on the right. Each circle represents an individual year's difference from the 1951 to 80, the NASA convention of the base period. So circles that are above the dark line were years that were warmer than that period. Circles that are below the dark line are years that were cooler than that period. You can see a clear warming pattern, and especially consistent in the last four or five or six decades. You do tend to see some bouncing up and down superimposed upon a long-term trend. The global temperature series, when presented in this way, very much kind of resembles riding up an escalator over time and then jumping up and down while you're on that escalator. The long-term trip along the escalator, primarily that's a metaphor for the long-term global warming that we're seeing. And then the jumping up and down can be driven by internal processes. And again, Gavin's going to introduce us to the El Niño-La Niña phenomenon, which is one of the primary drivers of this up and down motion that we call internal variability within the climate system. One last thing to point out, as Gavin indicated also, the last 5 years are the five warmest years on record. The last 4 years are clearly the four warmest years on record. The blue bars, as shown in this graphic, represent the average for the 10 years in each of those decades. With that, I think we're going to look at NASA's analysis and pass it back to Gavin.
Thank you, Deke. So this is our version of that. I'll put them side by side in a second. As you can see, there are minor differences in a few of the ups and downs. And the differences between our analyses really come into play when it comes to extrapolating into areas that we think are warming quite substantially, but where we have slightly sparse data, particularly in the Arctic. And so the GIST temp record tries to extrapolate out as far as the data permits us, whereas the NOAA procedure is slightly more conservative in that respect. But normally that wouldn't make much difference, except that we know that the Arctic is warming quite fast, and I'll provide some more evidence of that a little bit later on. But the statistics that Dee gave, those turn out to be almost identical for the NASA record as well. One of the new things that we've been working on, and now I've gone on to slide six, one of the new things that we've been working on at GIST is really trying to understand the uncertainties in these estimates of global mean change. And we do acknowledge that there are margins of error in these estimates. So we are filling in increasingly sparse network as you go back in time. We do have to make corrections for non-climatic factors such as station moves and inhomogeneities in the methods by which these data were collected. And all of those things add a little bit of uncertainty to the product that we produce for you here. And this, the gray bars around the red line that you can see in slide six, that's the 95% confidence interval that we get from taking all of the uncertainties that come from the land stations, taking them from the ocean analyses, merging them, understanding the structural uncertainties in our methodology, and then accounting for the spatial sampling issues as we go back in time. And what we find is that for the recent period, the accuracy of these annual anomalies is within 0.05 degrees C, so about 0.1 degrees Fahrenheit. But that goes back in time, and by the time you get back to the late 19th century, the uncertainties are more like, or the confidence interval is more like 0.2 degrees Celsius. And so we do have less confidence when it comes to, you know, what happened in the early part of the 20th century or the 19th century. But the trends that we can see and the accuracy of what we're doing, particularly since the 1950s, is actually quite impressive. And we have a lot of confidence in these analyses. Deke mentioned as well, what are the impacts, what are the things that cause some of these ups and downs, as well as the long-term trends. And if you go to now slide seven, this is an attempt to try and pull out the impacts of the El Niño-La Niña phenomena in the tropical Pacific. Generally speaking, when we have an El Niño, global mean temperatures are warmer in the year that follows. And if we start the year with a La Niña, the temperatures are a little bit colder. We can try and a statistical technique to try and pull that out. And that's the red line that you see. The black line is the same line I showed you before. The red line is what you would get if you make that correction for El Niño events. And what you see is that the amount of variance goes down, except for places where we had those big volcanoes, which are marked on the graph, Mount Agung in 63, El Chichon in 1982, and Mount Pinatubo in 1991. Those caused short cooling events in the global mean record, and we could pull those out as well. But the overall trends that still have a residual internal variability, but are mostly being driven by the underlying increases in greenhouse gases and the other forcings that are happening. If you take away the El Niño effects, what you would have found was that 2017 would have been the warmest year. And 2018 would have been the third warmest year. But the differences that that the El Niño or La Niña makes are listed on the side, and you can see it made a very big difference for 2016, and it made a slight negative difference for 2018. We're starting 2019 with mild, slight El Niño conditions, so that suggests that 2019 will be warmer than 2018. But that's more of a rule of thumb than a firm prediction. Moving now to the slide eight, we have there a selection of the global temperature records that are put together by different groups. So that's The first one is the GISTEMP, the NASA record. Then we have the Hadley Center, the Met Office CRU data, which comes from the UK. The NOAA data is there as well. And then there are two university-based estimates, one from Berkeley Earth, which is an effort to take perhaps a lot more data and use new statistical techniques to pull things together. And you can see that their data lies pretty much on top of everybody else's. And Cowton and Way, that's another effort that is based in the university where they're trying to improve the Hadley Center record by doing a better extrapolation to the polls. But all of those methodological differences are really not very important. There is some sensitivity to the sea surface temperature product that's being used. And of course, as you go back to the late 19th century, the differences between the different methodologies are increasing. But in terms of, you know, what the long-term trends have been and what the pattern of those trends are, all these analyses are extremely robust and show pretty much exactly the same conclusions. So slide nine, we obviously are very concerned about what's going on in the Arctic. We have a large decrease in Arctic sea ice, particularly in the summer and in September, which is the minimum sea ice period in the Arctic. But there's also a decreases in the winter as well, but they're less pronounced. And that's related to the fact that the Arctic is warming far more than the global mean. So in the inset, we have an estimate of what's going on in the Arctic region, 64 north and poleward, compared to the global mean. And you can see that the rate of warming is between 2 and 3 times faster in the Arctic than it is in the global mean. And that's something that we expect. It's a phenomenon called polar amplification. But it does mean that the impacts of these changes on the global mean are really being felt regionally in the Arctic much, much more strongly than they are, say, in the tropics. And I think the last slide that I'll talk about is slide 10. The question comes up pretty regularly. How do we know that the trends from these weather stations or from the ocean data, you know, can we independently evaluate how good these trends are or how good these patterns are? And the answer is yes, we can. So ERA5 is a reanalysis. It's just been issued by the ECMWF. This is a weather model that ingests observational data that's independent of the station data that we're using to pull together the changes in climate over the satellite period, particularly 1979 through to 2018. We can compare almost exactly like for like, I could go into the details of that, the trends and the patterns in the ERA5 analysis and the GISTEMP trends. And what you see is that kind of by design, the GISTEMP trends are smoother. That's really just a function of how we aggregate the data. So, but if you just kind of smooth the ERA5 trends by eye, what you see is the patterns are actually very alike. And there's a very high spatial correlation between the patterns, and there's a very high correlation in magnitude between the trends that you see. With a notable exception that in the Arctic, the reanalysis is seeing warmer trends than the GISTEMP record is extrapolating. And that could be important. We have additional independent evaluation using remote sensing. So AIRS is an infrared instrument on the Aqua satellite, and that's been in orbit since 2013, which gives us the opportunity to look at the trends over that 16-year period, 2013 to 2018. And again, the trends in the patterns are very congruent. But with an indication that the Arctic is warming more in the real world or in the satellite trends than we're capturing in the station-based analyses. And that's obviously something that scientifically we're going to be looking into going forward. Deke, over to you.
Thank you, Gavin. So very quickly, we're going to look at conditions across the United States in 2018 and kind of review temperature, precipitation, drought, and disasters in the next four slides. So slide 11 shows temperature patterns for what was ultimately a warm year in the U.S. The year was about a degree and a half Fahrenheit warmer than the 20th century average, and it was the 22nd consecutive year above that 20th century average. Compared to the long-term period of record, this was the 14th warmest of the 124 years on record. Looking at the big map on the left, that shows regionally how annual temperatures fit into this long-term history. Areas that are the darkest red show places that had their warmest year on record. The orange color shows areas that had a year that was in the top 10% of their history. Areas with the light orange show places that were in the warmest third of their history. So you can see the western U.S. and the eastern U.S. Typically, we're in the warmest parts of their history. Some parts of much of the northern plains and upper Midwest had a year in the white color, which indicates in the middle third of their history, with some little patches of below average or in the lower third of their history as well. So when you average all of that together, you end up getting an average temperature that was 14th warmest for the period of record. The two maps on the right that are slightly smaller are the same type of analysis, but the top map is for maximum or afternoon high temperatures, and the bottom map is for minimum or morning low temperatures. And you can see a distinct difference in this map that low temperatures in the east and maybe even more in the Pacific Northwest as well were quite a bit warmer relative to their own average than afternoon temperatures. And you can see in the plains, the northern plains, that afternoon temperatures are actually on much more on the cool side of their history as well. This is one of the most kind of significant and emergent themes in the 21st century that we've seen in U.S. temperatures. It is expected kind of by the Science Academy, and the observations are playing out that morning time temperatures are increasing more rapidly than afternoon temperatures, and we've seen the majority or even the vast majority of the months in the last decade or so play this out. So if you were to do the rankings for the afternoon temperatures, you would get 27th warmest out of the 124 years on record, but the morning time temperatures are actually 7th warmest. So a distinct a difference in kind of the way our mornings are driving much of the warming that we're seeing over time. Moving on to slide number 12, this is a similar analysis for precipitation. So this shows precipitation patterns that were observed during our third wettest year on record for the U.S. On average, this was the wettest year since 1983, and the sixth consecutive year and 10th of the last of 11 years that were wetter than the 20th century average. Much of that wetness or additional precipitation was focused east of the Rockies and especially in the mid-Atlantic and upper Midwest. In the mid-Atlantic, springtime rains were very large, and then we had the remnants of several hurricanes and tropical systems that came through in the late summer and fall and added to that total. So where you see the dark green, those places had their wettest year on record, and nine states in the east, east of the Appalachians, had their wettest year on record as well. The West was largely dominated by dry conditions. Large parts of Colorado and Oregon had precipitation totals among their bottom 10% of their record. And then one other precipitation data point, it's not shown on this map, but Waipei Garden in northern Kauai, the Hawaiian island of Kauai, set a new all-time record for the most precipitation observed in a 24-hour period in the U.S. 49.69 inches fell in a 24-hour period that spanned April 14th and 15th. And that, again, is a new U.S. 24-hour precipitation record. Moving on to slide number 13, which shows drought conditions, and specifically it shows the number of weeks during 2018 that were categorized as in drought by the U.S. Drought Monitor. So the darker color on this map, the more weeks that were spent during 2018 categorized as drought. Drought was entrenched all year across much of the Southwest, the Four Corners region, and then in parts of North Dakota and adjacent parts of the Canadian Prairie. During the year, we began the year with drought in the east that went away rapidly in this very wet year. An intense drought episode in the Southern Plains, Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, was eradicated about halfway through the year, and at about that same time, a drought center that was centered in Oregon really intensified and then expanded throughout much of the Pacific Northwest. So the story of drought this year is what you would expect with a very wet year east of the Rockies and Mississippi that basically spent most of the year out of drought and then an entrenched and very intense drought, frankly, in the Four Corners region. Finally, the last slide is an update to our billion-dollar disaster metric. And what this is it lists the events that were that caused at least $1 billion in direct losses based on the event. In 2018, we had 14 of these individual billion-dollar disaster events. The record for these, the economic data dates that we use dates back to 1980, and the cost of inflation is accounted for in this analysis. So all of the years in the record are compared using 2018 dollars. So this total number of 14 billion-dollar disasters is the fourth largest of that period. So this year's total of 14 is compared against an average in any given year since 1980 of 6.2. So we had about twice the number of billion-dollar disasters this year than we have in an average year and over the last 40 years or so. If you think about the period 1980 through 2019, that kind of breaks in half roughly, and half of that's in the late 20th century, half of that is in the early 20th century. If you look at the last 20 years of the 20th century and the first 19 years of the 21st century, the averages are pretty striking. The 20th century years averaged $3.7 billion disasters per year. In the last 19 years, that more than doubles to 8.5 per year. So this is increasing that trend. Again, that's using 2018 dollars. The total direct losses associated with these 14 events were $91 billion. That's also the fourth largest total of the record. Three of those events, Hurricanes Florence and Michael, and then the complex of wildfires that throughout the West through much of the year accounted for $73 billion of that $91 billion total. And I believe that does it for our prepared remarks. And I'll hand it back to John Leslie.
Thank you very much, Deke. At this time, we will now take questions from the media. Please indicate who you'd like to answer your question. Operator, please remind the participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first one.
Thank you. We will now begin the question-answer session. To ask a question, please hit star 1. Please ensure your phone is unmuted and you record your name and organization clearly when prompted. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. To withdraw your request, press star 2. One moment while we wait for the first question to come in. The first question is from Seth Bornstein from the Associated Press. You may go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I actually have two questions. The first one is for both Deke and Gavin. The UK Met Office is forecasting that the next 5 years will likely be between 1.03 and 1.57 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial, which would basically be 5 years that are warmer on average than the last 4 years we've had. So they're predicting more record-breaking heat. I'm wondering, does that make sense to you, and why is it likely we're going to get even, the next 5 years will be even hotter? And then the second question, mostly for Gavin, is in on that slide 7, when you're taking in the El Nino, the ENSO factor, taking that out, and you said this year was third warmest, because when I just want to double check, because when I eyeball that map, it looks to be second. I mean, it's hard to tell. Can you go through what those top three are in terms of temperatures? And so, thank you.
I'll take the first crack at that. I can send you the actual numbers for the El Nino corrected estimates when we're offline. But I think it just looks like 2016 is kind of just in the middle of the line there. So the top three, 2017, 16, then 18, then 15, 14. Would be the ordering, but I can send you the exact numbers later on. As for the Met Office prediction, excuse me, that's based on their decadal deck press system, where they initialize a large set of current models and kind of set them off, and they show what they do. There's an underlying trend, obviously, that you can see in the data, and that's actually pretty predictive. And then assuming that there'll be an El Nino or a La Nina at some point, we do anticipate that the next El Nino will also bring about near record or perhaps record temperatures. I can't really speak to the skill of their new predictions. I haven't really looked at that. You'd have to probably talk to somebody at the Met Office directly.
Okay, Deke?
Yeah, this is Deke. I agree with Gavin. I don't have a great deal to add other than, going back to that escalator metaphor, part of that over the next 5 years, that escalator, which represents the rate of large-scale global warming driven by greenhouse gas concentrations, that escalator will continue to move up. The longer you are on that escalator, the closer you are to the top range of the temperatures. It is the kind of bouncing up and down internal variability that provides maybe some of the detail over the next 4 years, or the next 5 years. But the long-term trend is up, and it's being driven by those greenhouse gases.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from Brian Sullivan from Bloomberg News. You may go ahead.
Hi. excuse me. What I'm curious about is what kind of link is there between the billion-dollar disasters and the extreme weather? Is there a link between that, the changes in climate, I should say, and or is this just an indication of folks in the U.S. living places they shouldn't?
Hey, Brian, this is Deke. So we do not attempt to take apart the contribution from changes in climate or changes in extreme weather events and changes in kind of in where people live and the wealth. So this is a combination of those two factors, and we do not actively try to pick that apart. Some of the types of events that are increasing in the billion-dollar disaster portfolio are inland flooding and extreme heat, and those are clearly increasing in the climate system. But again, we can't exclude some of these other economic factors, like that we've become a wealthier nation and are moving into the Sun Belt over the last few decades.
Thank you.
The next person is Curtis Alexander from the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you. You may go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my question. Just to follow up on Brian's question, I know you don't parse apart the cause and the effect of the increasing temperatures and the number of billion-dollar disasters, but is it fair to assume that there is at least some driver in the temperature behind the increase in the number of disasters?
Well, yes. So we, I guess what I'm trying to say is we do not try to quantify the relative role of climate change, underlying economic conditions, and kind of the randomness of weather events. I think it is safe to say that we are seeing more extreme rain events and more extreme heat events. That does appear to be the case as well in the time series of the billion-dollar disasters, but we wouldn't go so far as to quantify what percentage of that is driven by which component.
But at least some of these events are driven by the increase in temperatures.
There's an emerging field of climate science that's called attribution science that kind of will break down a particular event and an extreme event and kind of give the some sort of quantification for how much more likely would this event was this event given we live in a warming world and how much the world is warmed. And those studies look at each event on an event-by-event basis. There's a whole series in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, basically an annual report, that will look at a dozen or so big events and try to characterize how much more likely they would be. I'm very, very much oversimplifying right now, but, you know, a fair number of the events, particularly those related to heat and some related to very big rain events, have been characterized as made more likely in a warming world. And then there are other events that where they could not confidently make that connection.
Thank you.
Our next call comes from Nicole Mortarello from CBS News. You may go ahead.
Hi. I think this is pretty much directed at Deeks. I'm actually from CBC News in Canada. And we saw intense fires in BC this year. So do those drought conditions extend into Western Canada that you talked about and could be contributing to these fires? And actually, I have a second question, which you mentioned the morning temperatures are higher, and I've seen a trend here in Canada where overnight temperatures aren't hitting quite as low as they used to. Is this a trend?
Hi, yes. Answering your second question first, I'm not intimately familiar with the Canadian data specifically, but in the U.S., yes, we see that as well. We see that as a good rule of thumb, and this is good in a kind of a 4 out of 5 kind of way. The cold times of year are not reaching the depths of cold that they used to. The cold times of day are not reaching the depths of cold that they used to. And the colder places are not reaching the depths of cold that they used to. Again, that's a rule of thumb with plenty of exceptions. But we are seeing that as well here in the U.S. And when you look around the Northern Hemisphere as a whole, that is true as well. Your first question was about drought-driven fire in BC, I believe. The North American Drought Monitor product, which is a collaboration between NOAA and the Meteorological Service of Mexico and Environment Canada, you can kind of look at a month-by-month depiction of drought. I will say, without looking at the maps right in front of me, the drought that we saw in the Pacific Northwest in the U.S., Pacific Northwest, did extend into BC during several months during the year. I don't know enough about the situation in BC to characterize it any better than that.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Mark Iran from Vox. You may go ahead.
Hi. thanks for taking my call. Piggybacking on a couple of the last questions about the disaster totals, One thing you've noted in your write-up is that the billion-dollar disasters are a larger and larger percentage of the cumulative damage. Wondering what that also says about the small end or the tail end of the disasters. Is the United States getting better at mitigating or adapting to smaller-scale events, and that's why the larger events take up a larger proportion as well, or is there another effect at work? And then will there be a cost breakdown per disaster released at some point?
So, this is Deke. I can answer the second question directly. Yes, each event does have a cost breakdown associated with it. You should be able to find that in the table, or at least a total accumulation. We don't break down within the totals. For your first question about the role and cost of disasters on the kind of the lesser end, I'm going to have to get back with you. If you can contact John Leslie, we'll get the scientist that is more intimately involved with that product to give you a call, and he should be able to speak with you about that.
Thank you.
Our next caller is Penny Starr from Breitheart News. You may go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I guess this would be for, I guess this would be for Gavin, but I'm not sure. According to the Energy Information Administration, in 2017, carbon emissions in the United States fell slightly. You also brought up the statistic of 2018 being the fourth warmest, which would indicate a lowering slightly of temperatures. Do you draw any correlations with what is being done in the United States to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and your forecasts?
Hi, thanks for the question. Carbon dioxide is accumulated in the atmosphere, and it really is quite well mixed. So the emissions from any one country in any one year aren't that determinative of how much the change in carbon dioxide is per year. The change that we had in the last year was over 2 ppm increase, and we anticipate that that's going to continue as long as the carbon sources and sinks are out of balance, which they are by quite a long shot right now. And so our, if you like to think of it as an accelerator on the climate, we still collectively have our foot on that accelerator. And while there are some indications in some parts of the world that people are working quite hard to reduce those emissions, collectively we are not doing so. And so when you're trying to predict what's happening to the climate, which is obviously a global issue and it requires an understanding of the global emissions and the global changes in concentration, the year by year changes are not that important. Though it is important to keep track of what it is that we're actually doing. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Our next question comes from Megan Bartels from Spacecom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thanks. I have a question for Gavin. Could you speak to the role of satellites in these results? The only specific reference I see is to the AIRS instrument, but are there other space-based technologies involved? And for AIRS, because Aqua has already been in orbit for twice as long as its planned mission duration, are there any plans to replace it?
Okay, so there's a lot there. So the NOAA and the GISTemp analyses of surface temperature, they're deliberately based purely on ground-based in-situ observations. And the importance of that is that that record allows us to go back much further in time, much longer than the satellite records exist. But the satellites that we have now, or since about 1979, They are producing very useful data, not just about temperatures at the ground, but temperatures throughout the atmosphere, humidity, cloudiness, and that goes into products like the reanalyses, which then can be used, as I tried to indicate, as an independent check on what it is that we think we're seeing in the in-situ data. So there's quite a good reason, kind of scientifically, to keep these data streams separate. But when you do put them together and then you kind of compare, you know, what they're doing and with the different issues that each kind of data collection has, what you see is that the broad picture is very consistent. Now, as to the future of the Earth Observing System, that's slightly above my pay grade to discuss. Obviously, you know, Aqua and Terra and GRACE and the other satellites in the A-Train constellation have been enormously valuable in terms of understanding what's going on the planet and the trends that we're seeing in temperatures, in ice mass, in oceans, in land cover. And without that, we would really be flying blind. And so, you know, my personal opinion is that yes, we should be building future capacity, but I'm not high enough up in NASA to know exactly what the plans are.
Got it. Thank you.
Our next call comes from Maddie Stone from Earther.com. You may go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. I was hoping that this is probably for both Gavin and Deke. If you could talk a little bit about how the U.S. government shutdown impacted either the data collection or the analysis that went into this report, if it did, and whether a future shutdown, should that occur, will continue to have impacts on the data you folks are collecting and the analysis of that data on global and regional climate.
Hi, Maddie. Thanks. This is Deke. I'll take the first crack at this. So obviously, we could not do processing or data ingest during the shutdown. When we did come back online, we were very deliberate in making sure that the data had come back together, that we had the data that we were expecting to make sure our processes and procedures recovered correctly. And, you know, we wanted to get this done expediently because these data are used out there in the economy and not just for scientific analysis. So, you know, obviously there was a delay in the availability of the late 2018 and early 2019 data, but once we came back online, our main concern is the integrity of the data, making sure that we can share this with our partners and get that back online.
From our side, this is Gavin. We were unable to process the data and have access to the data that that NOAA was working on until after the shutdown was over. But once that was done, you know, we were able to process things in relatively short order.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Steve Filmer from Arizona Public Television. You may go ahead.
Hi, thank you. This could be for both gentlemen, but the big question is Urban Heat Island a part of this story in any way? Deke had mentioned in the continental U.S., looking at the differentials between, for instance, morning and afternoon temperature changes, either in the small picture or in the big picture, do you folks think Urban Heat Island is part of the story here?
Hi, this is Deke once again. So the data that go into the global analysis and the nationwide analysis has been examined by and corrected in cases by algorithms when there is a change detected in the environment of a station, as might be the case of an encroaching urban footprint upon an observing station. So when stations move or when the environment around that station changes and it changes the behavior of that station significantly, we will go in and make the corrections that the map kind of dictates. With that said, in the U.S. especially, the vast majority of our stations are still rural stations, so we still have quite a healthy baseline to kind of validate these approaches as well. The urban heat islands are definitely a real thing, and in the urban environment, they do contribute to the increase in the morning time temperatures. That the change in that is largely not reflected in our global temperature assessment. We tend to correct kind of for those changes in behavior. And I'll stop there.
To Gavin here. So we have an attempt to reduce the impact of any urban issues by taking trends from the rural stations instead of urban stations wherever we can. And it turns out that actually doesn't have much impact at the global scale. And if you look at the totally independent data from the AIRS instrument, for instance, over the U.S., it seems to indicate that that things are changing a little bit more than we're allowing for. So we don't think that that's a it's an important. I mean, it's important to take it into account when you're processing this data, but it is not an important residual in the data that we presented today.
Great, thank you.
Our next call is from Laura Gagle from Live Science. You may go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I think this question is for Deek. I was wondering if you could just go into the science a little bit more about why some morning temperatures are warmer and other afternoon temperatures are cooler in certain parts of the U.S.
Thanks. This is Deek. I'll take a crack at it. The climate system is complex, so this is probably an overgeneralization. But what is anticipated is that in a warming world, and especially in a more humid and warming world, that we would see increases in overnight temperatures kind of outpace increases in daytime temperatures. And a big part of that is, and this is going to get a little technical, but the layer of the atmosphere that's closest to the surface where we live shrinks overnight. As the kind of overnight cooling process goes, the kind of layer of the active part of the atmosphere shrinks, and so this kind of warming influence can be kind of amplified in what we would call a lower boundary layer environment. During the afternoon, the active part of the atmosphere that's kind of in contact with the surface and experiencing the surface warming expands quite a bit, and a lot of the impacts are distributed more quickly throughout a greater depth of the atmosphere during the day. That is one of several kind of factors that would help increase the rate of warming during the overnight periods as well. Increased cloud cover is also a big factor in that if we see increased cloud cover in places that are getting wetter and are getting cloudier, that tends to keep sunlight off of the ground during the daytime and also trap more additional heat during the overnight hours.
Thanks.
Our next call comes from Tom Yolesman, Discovery Magazine. You may go ahead.
Yes, thank you. The continuing drought in the western United States, and particularly the Four Corners region, seems quite striking. And to my non-expert eyes, it seems like a continuation of aridification that began in about 2000. So I have two questions. What climatic factors are contributing to this? And also, would it be fair to say that this is the emerging new normal for the region?
Hey, this is Deek. I'll take a crack at that. I don't know if I would be prepared to say that this is the new normal. I will say that the various ways of assessing drought in the West would align with your observation that beginning in about the late 1990s, we have entered into kind of a persistent area with kind of longer or larger drought episodes, both in terms of the spatial extent of the drought, the intensity of the drought, and the frequency of drought in the West. I am not prepared to say whether that is a new normal or not, but that has certainly been a larger piece of the experience in the American West in the last 20, 25 years.
And then the climatic factors?
Sorry, Gavin here. Let me add one little bit here, is that work that people have been doing in our lab has been examining some of those attributional issues with drought in the West and Southwest. And while the rainfall amounts that are leading to this drought are not historically or paleo-historically that unusual. I mean, these things have happened before in the last 1,000 years or so. The drying that we get in the soil because of the increased temperature, which is attributable to increases in greenhouse gases, that's actually been a significant factor in the intensity of the droughts and the impacts that they're having. So there is, some things like the rainfall itself, we're not detecting a change that's due to climate yet, but we are detecting a change because of the increased evaporative load that's due to the warmer temperatures.
Our next call comes from John Roach from AccraWeather. You may go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I just had a quick question about when you referenced direct losses. Looking at your numbers, the Western wildfire seems relatively low, and I'm wondering if direct losses is just a two-day span or a week span. Could you kind of clarify that for me?
Again, I'll have to ask you to get in touch with John Leslie for more technical details about those analyses. There is a standard set of criteria and economic data sets that we look at that. I don't have that at my fingertips, and you should probably – I think you'd be better served by having our expert get in touch with you.
Okay, thank you.
Our next call comes from Alex Harris from Miami Herald. You may go ahead.
Hi there. I'm just wondering if you guys have any more specific satellite maps talking about changes in ocean surface temperatures or rankings where they'd fall among other years. I'm kind of curious of the Gulf of Mexico in relation to Hurricane Michael.
Hi, Gavin. Yeah. So we do keep track of the anomalies for land and ocean independently, and then they're merged to get the global estimates. Ocean temperatures are similar to land. If you look at the global mean, so 2018 would be the fourth warmest year for the global SST, sea surface temperatures. But the changes in ocean temperatures are smaller than over land because of the heat capacity of the ocean. So things change a little bit more slowly and less dramatically. But the trends obviously are up in the same way that they are over the land.
This is Deke. Without contradicting anything that Gavin just said, one of the things that we started doing this year, we're looking at kind of cutouts at specific pieces of the ocean system that are of interest to the United States. And according to our calculation, the Gulf of Mexico region had its third warmest year on record this year. I can get you more details if you'd like offline.
Yes,
if you want to contact John.
Okay, will do. Thank you both.
One moment, please, for the next question. Next question comes from Tom Henry from the Toledo Blade. You may go ahead.
Yeah, hi. This is probably best for Deke, although Gavin certainly response would be welcome too. Trying to localize this for the Great Lakes region where I am. The results this year weren't incredibly dramatic. It appeared a little colder than normal. fairly wet, which isn't that unusual for us. Not a whole lot in terms of billion-dollar disasters or things like that. I mean, are there general statements you can make about what's happening in the Great Lakes region and what, you know, to kind of underscore some of the things that may differ from what people in this part of the country have heard about climate change in their own region over the years?
I can speak right away about 2018. It was a wet year throughout the region, and particularly in the eastern Great Lakes, getting on into western PA and the eastern lakes as well. So that was consistent with the pattern overall in the U.S. and is consistent, generally speaking, with a tendency towards more precipitation in the eastern U.S. in recent decades. For more specifics about kind of longer-term changes, that's probably a more in-depth conversation. And so we, if you can get in touch with John Leslie, we can have one of us speak to you. Our lead U.S. author happens to be from the Great Lakes region, so she may wish to talk with you about longer-term trends.
Okay.
Our next call comes from Junya Yabuchi from NHK News. You may go ahead.
Hello, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, this is for both, what's kind of the key message that you would like for the general public to take away from kind of seeing this data?
Gavin here. The key message is that the planet is warming. The long-term trends are extremely robust. There's no question about those trends existing in the data, however we slice it. And our understanding of why those trends are occurring is also very robust. It's because of the increases in greenhouse gases that we put into the atmosphere over the last 100 years. But, you know, I think it's also, you know, the interest in new records or the interest in extremes. I think it's part of what people are interested in. And so while, like, scientifically, we're not terribly excited by the rankings that we talk about every year, people like that, it seems. And when you have a statistic like, you know, the last 5 years or almost 5 years that we've ever seen, that seems notable. And so that would be my bottom line. Dick?
Thanks, Gavin, for articulating that so well. The only thing I'd add is we are seeing also, and then 2018 was an exclamation point, I think, on a trend that we're seeing towards more big rain, particularly in the eastern United States. And that is connected with the long-term warming in that a warmer atmosphere can convey more water vapor when a storm forms. And if a warmer atmosphere can convey more water vapor, those rain-making storms can deliver more water in the form of precipitation. And so there is an obvious connection there. So it's not just these larger global-scale statistics that we track, but these changes are having consequences on the ground. Gavin highlighted the situation in the Arctic, the kind of detailed changes that they're seeing there. But what, you know, we are already even here in the U.S. experiencing changes in precipitation, like I just mentioned, and then Gavin mentioned also a tendency towards more intense drought in the West as well. So that's that would be a point I would add.
Thank you.
Our next call comes from Alex Telashev from the Russian Newswire. You may go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for this opportunity. I have two questions to Gavin, if it's possible. The first one, you wrote several times about the Bali volcano eruption. Did it actually influence the results of the last year, or will it influence the next year and the current year? And the second question, do you have any prognosis for permafrost state in Canada, Alaska, and Russia?
Thanks. This is Gavin here. Yeah, so the body volcano didn't actually erupt, even though it didn't have a big explosive eruption, even though people were monitoring that quite closely. And my sister lives very close by, so it had more more than academic interest. But no, this year we did not have any big volcanoes that deposited sulfur dioxide or sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere, which is really the key element in determining whether they will produce a cooling in the subsequent year or 2 years after their eruption. The cases that I pulled out in slide 7, Agung in 63, Chichon, which is in Mexico in 82, and Mount Pinatubo, which is in the Philippines in 91, those were large tropical eruptions that put an enormous amount of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. And as you can see, they produce coolings of around 0.2 to 0.3 degrees Celsius in the year or two subsequent to those eruptions. But we haven't had anything like that recently, though obviously we monitor this quite closely. And should we see a large eruption like this that is likely to have climatic implications, NASA has a contingency plan to analyze and observe the processes that will be involved, and we will be able to update our prognoses very, very quickly upon such an event. But nothing that happened last year would trigger such a change in the prognosis. Your second question was related to permafrost. Obviously, you're almost certainly well aware that that permafrost is in retreat all across the boreal north, in Alaska, Canada, and Siberia, and northern Scandinavia. As the temperatures warm, and as you can see, the temperatures in the Arctic are warming faster than anywhere, the prognosis for permafrost and the carbon stores that are within that are not good. So I'm not a particular expert on permafrost, but my lay understanding of that is that we should expect continued and larger declines in the area of permafrost across that whole region.
Okay, thank you.
Our last question comes from Kim Miller from Palm Beach Post. You may go ahead.
Hi, this is a message for Deke. I'm just looking at slide 12 and noticing that, South Florida, where I am, is kind of sticks out as far as being dry. And I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about why, what happened last year that made South Florida drier than normal.
Hello, I apologize, Kim. I probably couldn't do that kind of attribution on the spot, but I have two resources, hopefully, that can help you. One, we do have an annual drought report associated with this national climate report, and you may be able to find some insights there. Then we also, through John Leslie, can get you in touch with the author of that drought report, who may be able to provide a little background on how the year played out.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I think we'll end here, and I'll just say that an audio of this call can be found on the NOAA Media Advisory page. That's NOAA.gov/media-advisories within about an hour from now. And if you have any further questions or data needs or need to set up a follow-up interview, please email me at john.leslie@noaa.gov. Or you can get in touch with my NASA colleague, Patrick Lynch, at patricklynch@nasa.gov. Once again, everyone, thank you for dialing in. This will conclude the call. Goodbye.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may disconnect at this time.